Now on News Talk, as part of our spring series of documentary on News Talk, producer Sorka Glacken looks at the life of Mary Harris Jones, the Cork woman who played a pivotal part in the American Coal Wars in Mother Jones, America's Most Dangerous Woman.
And I long to see the day when labor will have the destinies of the nation in her own hands, and that she will stand a united force and show the world what the workers can do.
Mother Jones, she was a fighter. Born for the dead and fight like hell for the living. And that's what she lived by.
She dedicated her life to them. She had lost her four children and her husband in a yellow fever epidemic, and she dedicated herself to making miners and other working people her children.
I mean, think about it. If she had stayed here in Cork and led her life here, American history would have been different. She left her mark on the United States.
My name is Gerard O'Mahony. I'm a coordinator of the Spirit of Mother Jones Festival. In 1977, when I was working in New York City, a friend of mine working in the same hotel as myself told me that he knew a very famous lady who had been born in Cork in Ireland, and he mentioned Mother Jones. It meant absolutely nothing to me, but he kept talking about it and mentioned that his grandfather had followed Mother Jones in the Mine Workers Union in America when, you know, maybe 56 years prior to that. So when I came back to Ireland, I was trying to figure out who was this lady, Mother Jones, and I got a copy of her autobiography where she was indicated that she'd been born in 1830 in Cork City in Ireland. And, you know, off and on, I would inquire in the libraries and various things to know, had anybody heard of her or whatever, and kept checking dates and things around 1930, but drew a blank.
I was born in the city of Cork, Ireland, in 1830. My people were poor. For generations, they had fought for Ireland's freedom. Many of my folks have died in that struggle. My father, Richard Harris, came to America in 1835, and as soon as he had become an American citizen, he sent for his family. His work as a laborer with railway construction crews took him to Toronto, Canada. Here I was brought up, but always as the child of an American citizen. Of that citizenship, I have ever been proud.
You know, we don't even know for sure what age she was when she came to Canada. Probably 13, 14, 15 or so. She had spent her certainly formative years in Ireland. She had seen the famine from North Cork, which means that she had seen people coming in to the city who were coming literally to die or to try to get out of the city and try to go through Cove and emigrate out. So she must have seen much of the worst of it from the very beginning in 46 until they left sometime in the early 1850s. We don't even know for sure. My name's Elliot Gorn, and I'm the author of a biography of Mother Jones, Mother Jones, the Most Dangerous Woman in America. Mother Jones says in her autobiography that her father left Ireland because of some revolutionary activities that he was into, that her ancestors had all been involved. That certainly might be true. I actually spent a lot of time trying to find some record of that and never did find anything. And I'm a little bit doubtful. In the city of Cork, in the time when she was talking about, there wasn't that much going on that a man like Richard Harris, her father, would be involved in. I suspect that, like many immigrants, it was easier to say that than it was to admit really that they were famine immigrants, which terrible to say, in addition to the famine itself being so horrible, there was a lot of shame attached to leaving under those circumstances. She never spoke of the famine, although it's very clear from the record they were right in the middle of it. So much is in shadows with Mother Jones. You can find bits and pieces. There's the story she tells in her autobiography, which isn't always reliable, but we do know that in Canada, first she studied to become a teacher at what became the Normal School in Toronto, that she left when she was a young woman, about 1859, took off first for Monroe, Michigan, and became a teacher in a convent school, then to Chicago for probably just a few months. And either in Chicago or in Memphis itself, where she ended up, she met a man named George Jones, who was an iron molder, a very skilled trade. He was a union man. And they were married by 1861. And in the next few years, they have four children.
In 1867, a fever epidemic swept Memphis. Its victims were mainly among the poor and the workers. The rich and the well-to-do fled the city. Schools and churches were closed. People were not permitted to enter the house of a yellow fever victim without permits. The poor could not afford nurses. Across the street from me, 10 persons lay dead from the plague. The dead surrounded us. They were buried at night, quickly and without ceremony. All about my house I could hear weeping and the cries of delirium. One by one, my four little children sickened and died. I washed their little bodies and got them ready for burial. My husband caught the fever and died. I sat alone through nights of grief. No one came to me. No one could. Other homes were as stricken as was mine. All day long, all night long, I heard the grating of the wheels of the death cart.
It's one of the mysteries of Mother Jones's life is why she became such a dedicated troubadour for justice. She had a very hard life, leaving Cork during the Great Famine and going out on her own as a young girl, marrying a man in Memphis, Tennessee, losing all her children in a plague, losing him, losing her shop. So all of these hardships, I think, gave her a tremendous sense of empathy with people like her, working class Irish Catholic immigrant people in particular, who suffered through life but endured and became stronger as a result. One could be broken by the experiences that she endured, but she became stronger. And I think, having lost her children and her husband, I think she decided to become everybody's adoptive mother, particularly the mother of the coal miners, or even more, as they would say, their angel.
I returned to Chicago and went again into the dressmaking business with a partner. We were located on Washington Street near the lake. We worked for the aristocrats of Chicago, and I had ample opportunity to observe the luxury and extravagance of their lives. Often, while sewing for the lords and barons who lived in magnificence on the Lake Shore Drive, I would look out of the plate glass windows and see the poor, shivering wretches, jobless and hungry, walking along the frozen lakefront. The contrast of their condition with that of the tropical comfort of the people for whom I sewed was painful to me. My employers seemed neither to notice nor to care. In October 1871, the Great Chicago Fire burned up our establishment and everything that we had. The fire made thousands homeless. We stayed all night and the next day without food on the lakefront, often going into the lake to keep cool. Old St. Mary's Church at Wabash Avenue and Peck Court was thrown open to the refugees, and there I camped until I could find a place to go. Nearby, in an old, tumble-down, fire-scorched building, the Knights of Labour held meetings. The Knights of Labour was the labor organization of those days. I used to spend my evenings at their meetings, listening to splendid speakers. Sundays, we went out into the woods and held meetings. Those were the days of sacrifice for the cause of labour. Those were the days when we had no halls, when there were no high-salaried officers, no feasting with the enemies of labour. Those were the days of the martyrs and the saints.
I'm James Green. I'm a historian at the University of Massachusetts at Boston, and I'm a specialist in labor history, U.S. labor history, and I've just finished a book about the mine wars in West Virginia, which features Mother Jones very prominently as a central character in the story. The very first strike she got involved in 1894, she kind of adopted one of the strikers who, and she would do this her whole life, she would adopt these favorite sons of hers, who had gotten in deep trouble with the authorities. He was accused of blowing up a railroad trestle that was bringing troops to break the strike. And she took up his cause and tried to save him from doom. He would have been accused of treason and executed. Went to the White House to try to plead his case. And all of the men who had suffered from that great conflict. And apparently, the organization involved in that fight was called the American Railway Union. And at that point, apparently, she became known among those men as the mother of the ARU, the mother of the American Railway Union. And then it just became, from then on, a widely adopted name for union people all over the country.
She is known as the most famous socialist already by around 1896. She goes down to Alabama and she writes some exposés of child labor in Alabama in 1896. And it's really there that she becomes known as Mother Jones, too. And then she also becomes Mother Jones in trying to save a man's life. He's in prison for derailing a troop train during a pretty prominent strike in the United States, the Pullman strike against the railroads. And she goes to the President of the United States, and she says she's acting as a surrogate mother. And she demands an audience with President Cleveland, and she gets an audience, and he says he's going to talk to the governor of California. And so she becomes a phenomenon. She travels 15,000 miles with petitions all across the country, getting people, railroad workers and mine workers, to sign these petitions, and she saves his life. And in the midst of that campaign, there's a coal strike in Pennsylvania, and she goes there, and she's already well known because she's gone all over the country, and they call her in and they say, well, could you help us with this strike? She's not an official organizer at this time. And her first speech is to the women of the mines. She knows them. She's been organizing with them for this other campaign. And she says, fellow slaves, to these women, you need to act as women. You have to organize independently of the men. You have to shorten your skirts and march. And within days, people report that these women have responded. They set up their own committees, and they meet the troops with bayonets, lined up with bayonets, and face them down. And it becomes reported that she helps to win that strike.
She was a very public persona and remarkably skillful and knowing how to use the media to promote not just herself, but the causes for which she stood. She understood how you create a media event. She understood the value of building relationships with people in the press. And so we have an extraordinary amount of information about her. From her autobiography is not to be counted on in terms of particular accuracy, but there is enough third-party information. Yes, you can construct some very, very accurate information about her.
In the spring of 1903, I went to Kensington, Pennsylvania, where 75,000 textile workers were on strike. Of this number, at least 10,000 were little children. The workers were striking for more pay and shorter hours. Every day, little children came into union headquarters, some with their hands off, some with a thumb missing, some with their fingers off at the knuckle. They were stooped little things, round-shouldered and skinny. Many of them were not over 10 years of age, although the state law prohibited their working before they were 12 years of age. The law was poorly enforced, and the mothers of these children often swore falsely as to their children's age. In a single block in Kensington, 14 women, mothers of 22 children, all under 12, explained it was a question of starvation or perjury, that the fathers had been killed or maimed at the mines. I asked the newspaper men why they didn't publish the facts about child labour in Pennsylvania. They said they couldn't, because the mill owners had stock in the papers. Well, I've got stock in these little children, said I, and I'll arrange a little publicity.
My name is Cy Khan from the United States. I am a lifetime organizer and activist and a musician. She was very, very concerned with child labor. And she was also always very concerned with children. Now, this is a woman who had 4 children of her own who died of yellow fever at the same time that her husband died of yellow fever. So you don't have to psychologize to say, of course she became a mother to thousands of minors. And the cause of children, of child labor, I mean, in the United States and in Ireland, that the children went to work at 8 and 9 and 10, and they worked 14-hour days in the mines and the mills. And of course, today, there are countries where that still happens. So she wanted to dramatize what was happening to children in the mills and the mines.
We are in Ludlow, Colorado, halfway in between Walsenburg and Trinidad, Colorado. This is the site of the massacre where 75-plus people died as a result of striking. The miners were asking for safety, for pay standards, and the militia was brought down, and the strike got very, very ugly. Many, many people died. Here at Ludlow, they had the tent colony. And under the tents, they had pits where they stored meat and vegetables. And when the militia arrived with all of their machine guns and the big, what I would call a tank, the women and children went under the tents. When the militia opened fire, the tents caught on fire, and the people were cremated. This is an annual event in honor of our coal miners. The history of Huerfano County and Los Animas County, the good and the bad, are because of our coal miners. And so we dedicate our museum and this event in their memory.
I think it was about a 7-year labor strike with that CF&I, well, it wasn't CF&I at the time, but the steel workers had with the steel mill there in Pueblo, Colorado. And soon after that, she became elected as a state house representative from Pueblo, Colorado. And she is one that adds, a great deal to our program, and she does it in her particular fashion. She's been a sister of mine and a friend of mine, and would you please help me welcome the County Commissioner from Pueblo, Colorado, Buffy McFadden.
It's funny you mentioned fashion. I was asked why I was wearing heels today. And after listening to Cecil speak this week, if Mother Jones can get from Cabin Creek, West Virginia, to Ludlow, Colorado, after almost dying of pneumonia, being basically let out of jail by the governor of West Virginia, Mr. Hatfield, I can wear heels. You know, we've heard a few of the stories and many of the stories.
Okay, so we are now standing at the Ludlow Memorial, the Ludlow Massacre Memorial. And we're looking at a man, a woman, and a child. A woman is clutching the child. It reads, "In memory of the men, women, and children who lost their lives in freedom's cause at Ludlow, Colorado, April 20th, 1914, erected by the Mine Workers of America." We're now going to go down into the cellar in which 11 women and children died. So now we are in the cellar where 11 women and children died. It's probably no wider than maybe 10 by 6. And there were 11 people in here. Actually, there were more. There were 13 people in here. Two of the women got out, but their children suffocated. I apologize. I've been to Ludlow 10 times, but I've only been in here twice. This is the second time because the feeling in here is so eerie and infuriating in a way that people were forced to hide in something so small for hours and hours and hours at a time because other people felt it was okay to indiscriminately fire into the crowd with women and children through tents from far away with sniper rifles and machine guns.
Mother Jones was important in almost every labor struggle for the second half of her life. She inspired the miners to walk out. She challenged them to stand up for themselves. She came back to support them. And the commanding general here, a man named John Chase, who had been the commanding general in previous strikes, and everyone knew that he was an anti-union tool. And he incarcerated her without charges and before she could actually become an active organizer, because he knew how powerful she was. But she became a powerful symbol as she was jailed, and the women paraded to protest her incarceration. And Chase led the troops on horseback into this crowd of women, kicked one of them in the breast, fell off his horse in the process, which everyone liked a lot. Mother Jones, I think, both inspired people, but she was also a living symbol of why it was that this was such an important strike and how terrified the ruling class was, that they were terrified of women and children and an 80-plus-year-old woman who actually knew what they were fighting for and who understood their enemy.
You're listening to Mother Jones, America's Most Dangerous Woman, on News Talk 106 to 108.
There's this great story of Mother Jones in Trinidad before the strike. There's this fantastic theater there called the West Theater, and it's three balconies. And the story is her pacing back and forth on the stage, exhorting the men to go on strike, challenging their manhood. There's a line shouted about, if you aren't men enough to go on strike, move aside, the women will come in and do it, that kind of thing. And in that era, challenging a coal miner's manhood was a really good way to goad him into action. Governor Elias Ammons, the Colorado governor, and General Chase, who ran the National Guard that was deployed to the field, knew that wherever Mother Jones was, trouble was going to follow because she was such an adept agitator. So when she got into the district, they try to find a way to round her up and get rid of her. And there's this one hilarious scene where they grabbed her in Trinidad, stuck her on a train, sent her back to Denver. And she was done in the zone for the time being anyway. She was already making plans to go to Washington to meet with the Secretary of Labor and all these other people. So she was sending telegrams to Washington, in fact, telling them, I'm going to be here on such and such a date. And then the Denver papers carried stories quoting Ammons as saying that Mother Jones had been kicked out of the strike district and she would not be allowed back in, which just ticked her off. So she left. She knew she was being watched by detectives. She left her hotel by a side door, went to the rail yards, but not to the station. She went out to the yards themselves, looked up some union men, porters, and told them that she wanted to go to Trinidad and she wanted to be let out of the train about a mile short of Trinidad so she could sneak in. And she gave him, the porter, a couple of bucks to give to the conductor, to make this happen. So she got snuck on the train. She was on the train before it pulled into the Denver station. She was hidden on the train. It went south to Trinidad. It stopped short of the city. She gets out, makes her way to her hotel, and is holding meetings in a hotel room for 2 or 3 hours before General Chase realized that she was back in Trinidad. And then they arrested her again. And this time, they made the arrest stick. They wound up moving her to a local jail and then finally to a hospital where she was kept. The hospital was being used as a military base. She was being kept under guard at the hospital.
Nobody knows the exact death toll for the massacre that took place in Ludlow, but it's believed to be 20 to 25 people. And in the days following the police shooting up of the miners' encampment there, more people were killed. And when Mother Jones was giving a speech about this strike a year later, she summed up what really lay behind the defeat of the miners. She said the miners on their side had only the Constitution. The other side had the bayonets. Nobody really knows the total of the dead for the whole year that the strike went on. Certainly the toll was at least 50 altogether.
Ludlow, for me, connects a long, long history of labor struggles with the reasons the miners fought, or the reasons workers fight, which is to make their world better for their families, to be able to give their children a better future. And the children and the women who died here vividly remind us of how much they risked to do that. Today, organized labor in the United States and elsewhere is under severe attack. In the States, it's under attack, I think, more severely than at any time before the 1930s. People still struggle to make a living wage. The U.S. Congress is having trouble passing even a $10.10 living wage. Children still go to substandard schools. Children of color and the children who died here at the time were racialized as being darker and different and foreign. Children of color today are dying and being murdered way disproportionately to white children. And the challenge here, the challenge from Ludlow, is for each of us to connect with the memory and go on to make the world better for the children yet to come.
Because even in the second half of the 20th century, many of the people in southern Colorado were still employed by CF&I. One person told us that they even removed books about Ludlow from the Aguilar School Library. Over the past year, we have heard many stories like this. It reminds us that the powerful not only control the events of our past, but they also control the memory of these events. The only reason we remember Ludlow today is because the United Mine Workers have erected a monument and have very deliberately and proudly held an annual memorial service. In addition to the mine workers, Ludlow has been preserved because of the brave and defiant memory.
Stories about all those struggles for justice early in the 20th century, late in the 19th century, don't tend to get taught very much. It's not a part of our history that's celebrated in schools. People learn a great deal about the founding fathers, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and so forth. They learn a great deal about the American Civil War. They learn very, very little about the labor struggles in this country, much, much too little. You know, there are some school teachers who feel differently, who care about this kind of thing and trade information and, you know, add additional things to the curriculum. But that kind of thing is not at all a big part of the American school curriculum. Its absence from the curriculum just reflects the general outlook of most people in this country, that this is a great land of opportunity for all. Everybody can become rich. Social mobility is unlimited. You know, if there were problems of exploited workers, horrible conditions in the mines or whatever, those were problems 100 years ago, but it doesn't really apply today. And of course, that's nonsense, because inequality is on the rise in the U.S. right now, as it is almost everywhere in the world, but it's especially so here. the differentials between rich and poor, between the 1% and everybody else, and really between, you know, the top tenth of the 1% and everybody else, are colossal, and they're growing. And they're growing because, you know, people at the top have so much inherited wealth. It booms as the stock market goes up, whereas people in, you know, the bottom half of the population are in a situation where their real wages, as corrected for inflation, have actually been flat or declining for 30 or 40 years now. So we really have a situation of rising inequality where those disparities between rich and poor are as great as they were 100 years ago when Mother Jones was alive. And we don't have enough Mother Joneses around today to make us want to do something about it. I'm Adam Hochschild, and I was one of the co-founders of Mother Jones magazine. I like to think that as we told little bits of her story in the magazine, people felt here was someone that it was easy to identify with because she fought for justice so hard, so long, and in such a colorful way. She wasn't solemn. She wasn't doctrinaire. She wasn't sort of strongly identified with one faction or another of this very fragmented left that we had in this country at that time. She had her eye on justice, and she had that sense of humor.
You know, I think you have to understand the influence of Mother Jones, not just from any single event, not just from the Colorado Coal Wars. She really is a presence in the American news and in the consciousness of American people, and especially workers, certainly by 1900 and going all the way to 1920. And for many, many causes and many, many events, her work with miners especially in West Virginia and in Colorado, but also in Pennsylvania, also in the what's called the central competitive field of the Midwest. But then she organizes brewery workers. She tries to organize women domestic workers. She organizes across trades. She's involved with the very founding of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. She is the founding mother, it's sometimes said, of the IWW. She's involved with the Western Federation of Miners, a very radical mining organization. The Mexican Revolution spills over in some ways into California and Arizona. She's involved with some of the Mexican revolutionaries. Matter of fact, in the 1920s, she goes to Mexico to the Pan American Conference of Labor. She's invited there. She's involved in so many events and with so many organizations. For years, she organized for the Socialist Party, traveled all over America, stumped for Eugene Debs for president. She was, in a way, everywhere. When she said to a congressional committee that my address is like my shoes, it travels with me, it was literally true. And it was that courage and that willingness to be everywhere that was so remarkable and that people commented on and understood.
In the aftermath of Ludlow, she is the major figure calling for not only nationalization of the mines, but for Rockefeller to settle. She goes to Rockefeller's offices. She goes to his house. She is everywhere, and she's basically embarrassing the heck out of him. You know, she doesn't really know what else to do except that it's a sort of a media campaign against him. And she also goes back, and she helps to reform the union at Ludlow. She gets the tent colonies. She helps to get the tent colonies going again. So she's doing a series of things. There is an attempt and a hope on her part, I think it's very misplaced, that the Wilson administration is actually going to force the company to recognize the union. It's not only her that believes that, but a lot of people in that union who believe that the government will come through for them. But unfortunately, it doesn't happen. And there is no union at Ludlow. There is a tense wartime situation that comes in. So this is World War I period. And workers win some, and they lose a lot. They lose a lot. And she is part of a kind of a radical cohort in the UMWA that is organizing and trying to organize not only for nationalization, but just worker ability to control their own conditions. And she really takes up with that sector after World War I is over. She takes up with the radical wing that wants to really press for workers' control of the industry. And now she not only has opponents in industry, opponents in government, but this group has opponents in their union leadership. John L. Lewis is an autocratic, bureaucratic leader. He comes from Iowa. He rises through the ranks. And Mother Jones says from the beginning, her encounters with him, she thinks that he is going to be the worst disaster that ever happens. He has never won a union election. He's been appointed. He kind of figures out and schemes about things. So she takes up with a series of miners' protests that argue that they need to get new union leadership. And that's really why she's buried in Illinois, because she, in 1923, says she wants to be buried with the men and women who are fighting John L. Lewis. And the Illinois is the center of that fight. So, in a nutshell, she is trying to make her burial meaningful for beyond her death. She thinks that it might be a long campaign, but that she will say, I want to be buried with those people who are fighting for a democratic union. And it's really also an explanation for why she's not well known, because after she dies, John L. Lewis stays in control. The people who are in Illinois and run that campaign against their union leadership die before they ever win anything. John L. Lewis stays in control of the union until the 1960s. So from 1922 to 1960, he's fully in charge of the union. And they write out Mother Jones out of the union's history. So here is this amazing icon. And then you get an autocratic union leader in who basically writes her out of their history books.
I always think that the struggles for justice in history are a grand tradition, and that we can fight that fight better today if we know who some of our predecessors were. It's why I like to write history. It's why I like to remember people like Mother Jones. If you look back in the past, you realize that there were always times and places where injustice was rife, where conditions were horrible, where people were being oppressed, and that there were always people who were fighting against these things. Sometimes they won, sometimes they lost. But they were inspiring people, and they should be models to us.
Mother Jones, in her late years, she's active right up until the early 1920s, but she's getting to be very old by 1920. She's 93 years old when she dies in 1930, so in the early 20s, she's really quite old, starting to suffer from rheumatism. She mentions in her letters when she dies of dementia, but that's much later. She's active in those early 20s years, again, the steel strike, many important causes, and also once again in West Virginia, another flare-up, always West Virginia, medieval West Virginia, she called it. She's active till near the end, and then she basically withdraws as she gets older and sicker, and as the labor movement moves on in some ways from her, away from her. She spends time with Terence Powderly and his wife. They become very, very close friends. She ends up living in the home of some folks in Hyattsville, Maryland, which is where she has a 100th birthday party. She's on May Day of 1930. She's really 93 years old, but she says it's her 100th birthday party. And then she passes away a few months later to really quite a bit of publicity in American newspapers, newsreel coverage. Her funeral is a pretty big event.
It's important to remember people like Mother Jones because she shows exactly how influential one person sticking to her beliefs can be on the world, both in small ways and in large ways. A lot of people these days tend to live within their own little zones and their own little lives and think that, you know, I'm not going to bother getting involved in that because I can't change it. Well, usually you can't change it, but sometimes you do. And she stands as, I think, a positive beacon for hope for people who actually want to achieve justice and equality in the world.
I want to put it up to the citizens, up to every honest man in this audience. Let me ask you here. Have your public officials any thought for the citizens of this state or their condition? Now then, go with me up those creeks and see the bloodhounds of the mine owners approved of by your public officials. See them insulting women. See them coming up the track. I went up there and they followed me like hounds. But someday I will follow them. When I see them go to hell, I will get the coal and pile it up on them.
We'll be right back.
Mother Jones, America's Most Dangerous Woman, was produced by Circa Glacken and was supported by a grant from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland as part of the Sound and Vision Scheme. To listen back to this or any other Newstalk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on Newstalk.